From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. And this morning, we talk with Eleanor Spencer Rice, PhD, who shakes your pet's family trees, peeks beneath their feathers, dives into their brains, and sometimes hitches a ride on their poops to uncover the meanings behind some of our animal friends' wildest behaviors. Then we talk with ophthalmic surgeon, physician, and neuroscience researcher, Dr. Mithu Staroni, who discusses how to optimize your brain to transform the way you work. She says we can harness the brain to work in several different gears, and her new book is hyper-efficient, so stay tuned.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Our next guest, Eleanor Spencer Rice, PhD, is an entomologist and the author of many nonfiction books. She joins us now to discuss her new book, about which one critic said, "You'll laugh so hard you'll snort." It's been a long time since I've snorted and laughed. But Eleanor, in her new book, Your Pet's Secret Lives, The Truth Behind Your Pet's Wildest Behaviors, shakes your pet's family trees, peeks between their feathers, dives into their brains, and sometimes hitches a ride on their poops to uncover the meanings behind some of our animal friends' wildest behaviors. Eleanor Spencer Rice, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much, Lynn. I'm so happy to be here.
As we said before we went on air, that we often talk about some pretty heavy subjects on Cool Science Radio, like theoretical physics and, you know, string theory. And so it's really nice and refreshing for you to join us and talk about, in a scientific way, you know, our animals that we love so much. You say that at least half of our households have some sort of animal in it.
Yeah, most of us have pets, in the United States anyway. And it's great because although pets do cost money and they take time, they also have big benefits for humans. Whether it has scales or fur or feathers, it can decrease your stress and it can help you form connections with other humans as well. It teaches you, having a pet helps you to feel more empathetic towards others, including people and animals. So pets are a great way to connect with everybody.
Well, so you have a PhD in entomology, which is funny because that word often gets mixed up with etymology, right?
Yes, that's what my dad tells people I am. Etymologist.
I love it.
So he used to say I worked for Terminix, so he's getting closer, I guess, in terms
getting
of...
closer. But entomology is the study of insects, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, etymology is the study of words, and entomology, which is what I do, is the study, or did, is a study of insects. So my PhD was studying ant behavior and the way that the world works together through the eyes of ants. This morning I was out in the woods and I was looking for this ant that you have out in Utah that plants seeds in the forest. And if you take these ants, they're called winnow ants, out of the forest, the herbs and wildflower abundance and diversity drops by more than half. So these tiny ants are helping to shape the entire forest architecture. They're so important. And anyway, that's what I didn't study winnow ants. They're just my favorite ants and I was looking for them today, but the ants are extremely important. And so are all insects. And y'all live in a great place to get out and look for your bugs.
This is good to hear because there are many infestations and invasions. I mean, no one likes to have ants inside their home. No one likes to have mice inside their home. No one even likes to have moths inside their home. So maybe you can tell us how you reckon with that. How do you get them outside, but maybe not kill them or,
That's a really good question.
Say to an entomologist.
Oh, no, it's real. I mean, when I finished my PhD, I was so proud of my research and I would tell people what I did and I would tell them about all the beautiful connections of the world. And no matter who I was talking to, if it was my grandmother, if it was my professor, if it was somebody who'd spent their whole life studying this, they all had the exact same question. They would all listen to my long talk, and then they'd say, "That's great, but how do you kill it?" You know, that's what we think about when we think about bugs. The problem is that we see the world with human eyes. So we see ants or moths or roaches or mice only if they're bothering us. We don't look around and see that there are trillions upon trillions of pieces of this world that aren't bothering us at all, and they're actually helping us to live and be happy. If you look at ants in your kitchen, which is a very common thing, it's really important to find out how they got in and what they're doing there. Because the ants don't really want to live in your house. You're just giving them an all-you-can-eat buffet. So if you can find out the spot where they're getting in, you can block it off. And if you squish that ant that's walking on your kitchen counter and you sniff it and it smells like blue cheese, it's probably an odorous house ant, which is one of the most common ants that's on your kitchen counter. It's actually scientifically proven that. I know the guy who did it. He took the smell that odorous house ants make, and he took the mold that molds blue cheese, and he blasted them through this chemical thing. And he found out that the smell that odorous house ants make to frighten you away is the same smell that the mold that molds blue cheese makes. So they do. They smell like blue cheese. They smell pretty good. And you can treat them with a liquid ant bait that has, you know, like borax in it or something. And it's not toxic really to you. You're not going to chug it. It's not toxic really to your animals. And you can get rid of the ones. You can just get them out of coming into your kitchen counter. Spiders, I wouldn't mess with at all. You know that 95% of the spiders that live in your house have never been outside. They've never seen the sun. They were born in your house. They have made their whole lives in this jungle that is your home, because the average human house in the United States has at least 100 different species of insects living in it. Even the cleanest of houses has that many species, not 100 insects, 100 species of insects. And they're all doing wonderful things in there. You do have roaches, but you also have these tiny little wasps that go around and look for roach egg purses and lay their eggs on the egg purses, and their babies hatch out and they swim around eating all the roach babies, and they burst forth and they have killed all the roaches. You know, you might have termites, but you have this tiny little lacewing larvae that crawls up to your termites, turns around, expels gas in their face, so the termites pass out, and then it picks them up and eats them. I mean, you've got all these wonderful things that are living in your home right now, doing wonderful stuff for you.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking with Eleanor Spicer Rice. She is the author of Your Pet's Secret Lives, The Truth Behind Your Pet's Wildest Behaviors. Well, let's talk about dogs. We've all seen it. Your dog needs to go, needs to poo, and it's going to spin around, the poo dance, find the right spot, turn the right angle. Well, apparently it's not just finding the right leaf to poo on. There's actually a much deeper science to their decision.
Yes, there is. And it's really interesting to watch after you figure this out, because it 9 times out of 10, this is what happens. So when your dog's going around and then they stop suddenly and you're like, finally, and this is a random thing that you do every day. What happens is that when the dog stops, he or she is aligning their body with the north-south axis of Earth's electromagnetic field. So they're either pointing north or they're pointing south. And the reason is, it's just a sign that they can detect the field. So we knew that dogs could go long distances to get home over places they've never seen before. Bobby the Wonder Dog went something like 4,000, I don't know, thousands of miles back to their home after he got left on vacation one time and showed up at the porch and was like, "Why did you guys leave me?" Right? But how do they get home? And one of the ways that we always thought was that they could detect Earth's electromagnetic field. Lots of creatures can do that. Cows can do that. Hammerhead sharks can do that. Lots of birds use that to help them navigate. But we weren't sure until we started watching them go to the bathroom. And researchers actually spent a lot of time watching dogs do their business. And they saw that when they were going number two, they were aligning their bodies up most of the time, north to south. Now, solar flares can affect this, weird weathers, bathroom emergencies, all kinds of things can affect this. But when a dog is comfortable and going to the bathroom, that's what they do. And cows, If you drive by a cow pasture, everything's cool. You see that cows are usually facing the same way. They're usually facing north to south. These herd animals that can detect the electromagnetic field feel comfortable when they line their bodies up that way. So if your dog is actually doing something pretty complicated, and even though it looks complicated, but you think that they're being ding-dongs, and they're not.
One thing I have never seen before, and again, yes, your illustrator, Rob Wilson, does it so well in the book, and it's so simple. The dogs have, they're giving a lot of signs by the way they're wagging their tails, including if you wag to the left or if you wag to the right, it means one thing or another. Tell us more.
That's right. So not every wag is equal. They all mean different things. And anybody who's watched a squirrel up in a tree has known that there's probably a lot of information that's being given through an animal's tail. A dog's wag, you see your dog use its tail when it's up. You know when they're happy to see you, they just pick their tails up and they're curious. If they're scared or if they're playing, they tuck their tails under because it makes it hard for them to get caught. So you can tell if they're cowed, they'll put their tails, they'll make themselves small. But the wags aren't equal either. So if the dog is wagging its tail to the left, that means it's nervous or if it's unsure. If it's wagging its tail to the right, they're happy, they've got energy, they're open to greeting. And one of the things that I thought was so fascinating about this left and right tail wag is that if another dog sees your dog wagging her tail to the left, that dog starts to feel nervous. Their heart rate starts to increase. They start to pant. They start to act nervous because it's a signal to other dogs that something isn't right around here. So the other dogs are picking up on what your dog is saying when she's wagging her tail or he. Mm.
Well, we could probably talk about dogs forever, because here in Park City, I would say that a dog as a pet is number one by far. How about in the rest of the country? And this might also lead me to the question of what is the weirdest pet you've ever seen someone have?
The weirdest pet I've ever seen. I worked at a vet when I was in high school because I thought I wanted to be a vet because I didn't know what an entomologist was. And this guy brought in a picnic basket. Now, this might be more common out west. I don't know. And the lid, it was like a little Yogi Bear picnic basket. He said, my baby's sick. And the lid of the picnic basket lifted up and there was a prairie dog inside. And that is the weirdest pet I have ever seen in my life of somebody keeping. What's the weirdest pet y'all have ever heard of somebody having?
There was somebody that he had a kangaroo.
What?
Yeah, and I think he said it was a service animal. Emotional support kangaroo.
Well, they'll punch you, won't they?
Probably.
He could be like his bodyguard.
Yeah, their boxing partner.
That would be useful.
What percentage of the country has dogs as pets? I mean, certainly in Park City, it's a higher percentage.
I don't know. I think it's something like 40% of America has a dog, but I'm not positive about that. We can look it up. But a lot of us have dogs and cats. Those are our most kept. But then we've got a bunch of other stuff too. A lot of us really lean into those reptiles. You know, some people have tarantulas. I had to give mine away because he escaped and went into the children who were spending the night with my children's sleepover bag.
Oh.
And went home with them and then came out when their mother was washing laundry and she's still not speaking to me. So we gave him to a guy who really likes tarantulas. So Thompson Jr. is gone. But I don't understand bonding with those. But some people have a really close bond with their reptiles and they have a really close bond with their tarantulas. We feel things for the things that we care for.
Well, let's talk about that bond because so often you think, oh, they only like you because you feed them. I mean, sure, dogs love you no matter what. But so many of these other pets, if you will, you know, it's like, oh, they only sit on your shoulder because they're hungry. Are they forming a real bond with us? Are they really pairing with us as humans?
It depends on the species, but all evidence points to yes. I mean, you look at your cat, for example, and you think, My cat does whatever my cat wants to do, whatever, you know. The truth is that we have evolved with our pets. We've been keeping cats for more than 1,000 years. And our cat's behavior has changed based on our behavior, but our behavior has also changed based on our cat's behavior. And this goes back to what we're talking about with bonds. So do either of you have a cat, by the way, or have you had a cat before? I had one a long time ago. You do. When you're sad, your cat can actually tell that you're sad. And has your cat ever come up to you when you're sad and bumped you, giving you a little bump? Yeah. And what do you do when you get bumped by your cat? What do you instinctively do?
You pet them.
Yeah. You reach out and you pet them. Your cat has trained you to pet them. But here's the second part of that. When you pet your cat, you release oxytocin in your brain, which is the same chemical that a mama makes when she's bonding with her baby. It's the same chemical that you make when you're falling in love with somebody. And your cat feels your pets and they make oxytocin. It's the same chemical. So you have evolved together on a chemical level where you are bonding together with this love hormone that you're bonding together. And it's almost as effective as antidepressants in some cases, where you get in this feedback loop where you get blissed out together. It happens with your dogs too. And I don't think that we've investigated how reptiles feel about stuff. I don't think we've investigated how birds feel about stuff, but I know that it's not just because they feed you, because you feed them, because they come to you anyway. If you're kind to them, they're kind to you. So there's something beyond what we're willing to say as scientists at this point. But as far as your pets are concerned, you do have a true, I mean, your cats and dogs are concerned, you do have a true bond of affection, true affection and love that is happening between the two of you.
Well, on the flip side of the gentle cat nudge, there's also the cat flailing their tail. I don't want to call it wagging, because isn't that typically a sign to leave them alone?
Yes, when they whip their tail back and forth, that is their hunting or their irritation signs. Yes. And the thing is, like, just as with, and this is, some people say, oh, my cat's a jerk or my dog's a jerk. But those are the people who are also not only recognizing bugs because they're pests, right? They're only noticing the things that bother them about these pets, and they're not wondering why they're doing them. So if you want to have another human, then get a partner that's a person. You know, they're completely different species, but they're still signaling to you real signals. They have a real language that you can understand if you take a few minutes to pay attention and wonder.
Eleanor, there's such a cute illustration of a dog with a backpack and a walking stick. And it's the story of Bobby the Wonder Dog, who in the 1920s walked 2,500 miles, over 2,500 miles, to reach his human family from literally coast, well, not coast, but from Indiana back to Oregon. This really says something about dogs, not only in terms of their ability to find themselves in the world, but about their sense of loyalty.
It really does. It does. It's amazing. I mean, if I was Bobby and my family left me, I would say, well, I'll go find my own family and do, But Bobby doesn't think that. Bobby's like, I'm going home. Because what happened was their family was vacationing and they couldn't find Bobby when it was time to go. So they just left. And Bobby went that whole way, walked that whole way over unfamiliar territory to get home. You know, and part of it is loyalty and part of it is instinct. Some animals I have a flock of homing pigeons that I keep here. They can fly home from over 1,000 miles away and they can only go home, whether they like me or not. Like I can't get rid of them because they will always come back. So, you know, some animals have to have home. When your birds in the springtime are lying in their nest and they're looking at the stars, they're learning their constellations above their nest. That's one of the ways that they find their way home. And there's so many creatures like us, I think. I don't know about you guys, but once I make a home, I want to get home. And I think that makes me happy that animals have their homes too, and they want to be home.
Yeah, that's incredible. So that says a lot about, well, next week I'm going on a several week vacation, a vacation in which I cannot take my dog Oscar with me. Mm-hmm. And I have someone coming to the house, but I'm wondering, you know, like we as humans who are connected to our pets, have a real loss of connection when we go somewhere without our pets. What is happening for the dog or for the pet?
They are also feeling very sad and they feel a loss of connection, but there's an immediacy too in the things that pets feel. So they are feeling very sad. They miss you. Some dogs and cats never get over it. They just can't. Some dogs and cats tough it out throughout the day and they're like, I'm going to eat my breakfast. I'm going to go for my walk. Oh, a squirrel, you know, and they can make sense out of the moments of the days, but some pets can't. They just are so tightly bound with their owners. But that comes down to socialization too. Some pets only see their owners. And so when they're in an unusual situation, they can't make sense of it because they've been habituated to this kind of feeling that they only need to be their owners. Elderly pets, unfortunately, no matter how you know, habituated they are to everything, they want, just like all the old people that I know in this world, they need their routine and they need their closest people to be around them when they leave. And it's heartbreaking because we do have to leave sometimes.
Well, let's talk about pets' memory, because I was up at a friend's farm last year and he has this great farm dog. I mean, I'm coming back in my next life as a farm dog. And Freya loved me. She followed me all over the place. And I was just back up there a few weeks ago. And before I got there, my friend was saying, oh, she won't remember you. Oh, no, she did. Oh, she certainly did. So was that a true memory, an imprint, or was she just like, oh, there's another girl on the farm, I'll just follow her around again, not remembering me from last year?
The pets form real memories about things. And just like with humans, unlike humans, they're more attuned to the things that make a memory, right? So a dog's nose is so much more powerful than our noses. And their memory is not just a memory of sight. Their memory is a memory of smell. Their memory is a memory of sound and of touch and of your gentleness towards them. And all of these things can combine within their senses to be you. So they might not think of your face. They might just think of your smell. I have memories on smells. You know, when my grandmother died, I went and got her perfume and I couldn't believe how much of her that I could feel when just from that smell. But it's just this whole bouquet of an experience that they're allowing themselves to experience. And that's really kind of helped. Thinking about that has kind of changed the way that I experience things to lockdown memories. I don't know about y'all. I like to be outside as a bug person. Bugs are bigger than they ever are in the year here. We're moving into fall. This is the show bug time. And when I go out in the woods, I try to hear things, to see what I can hear, to see, are the cicadas, they're fading, but the katydids are coming. Then the katydids are going to fade, and by winter, it'll only be crickets. So I'll have a memory of a time, not just of a place. And I think it's a great practice for all of us to kind of be like an animal in that way. And this kind of sounds a little woo-woo, but it's like taking a bath in this wonderful world that we live in and forming really, really beautiful and rich memories that will stay with us no matter which senses fade. You'll still have another piece of it inside of you.
For our listeners, we're speaking to Eleanor from Raleigh, North Carolina, when she starts speaking of katydids and we go, what, huh? What?
Oh, y'all don't have katydids.
No, we don't. We have other things.
Yeah. And the other creatures make noises on your end.
That's right. That's right. Well, the book is Your Pet's Secret Lives, The Truth Behind Your Pet's Wildest Behaviors. And our guest is Eleanor Spicer Rice. And Eleanor, before we let you go, I just have to ask you, why homing pigeons? It's very interesting, but why?
Well, like a lot of people during COVID, when they baked bread and made nice gardens, I got pigeons. And I thought it would be a great way I had little bitty children at the time, and I thought it would be a way to teach them to be gentle with things that are fragile. And so we started keeping them. And then once we started keeping them, we're like those reptile people that I don't understand. We fell in love with these birds, started naming them and talking to them. And now we've got a little flock out in the yard and we let them out and they fly around and then they come home. And we trained them and they're really neat. And there's a whole rich association in our country of people keeping pigeons as their thing.
Oh, well, that explains it. It's very interesting and so good for kids too, to grow up with pets, isn't it?
It really is. And it's not just children who are, experience normative feelings about life. It really is helps people, all children, children who have different experiences of different behaviors. It helps them to communicate and helps them to understand other people and the rest of the world by the way that they, because a pet is something that doesn't have to talk to you. It's not constantly asking you how you're feeling. You know, they might be constantly asking you for something to eat, like my dog Betty is right now under my feet. But it's shown to help children develop verbal skills. It's shown to help children develop empathy and care for the natural world just through this thing that's sometimes very unnatural to have in your house.
Again, your pet's secret lives. It's the truth behind your pet's wildest behaviors. So many behaviors we didn't get a chance to talk about today. But Eleanor Spicer Rice is our guest. Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. You guys are so wonderful. I really appreciate this.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
At some point in our days, weeks, and months, we all come up against trying to find ways to make our brains work better, to get more focus, to figure out how we work best and most efficiently. Well, enter our next guest, Dr. Meetu Staroni. She is a physician, neuroscience researcher, and ophthalmic surgeon who advises multinational corporations on mental performance and stress management. And she says we need a radical new approach, one that leverages the natural rhythm of the brain. In her new book, Hyper-Efficient, Optimize Your Brain to Transform the Way You Work, she says we can harness the brain to work in several different gears. And she joins us now to tell us more. Dr. Meetu Staroni, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, we all, as humans who use our brains, would love to use them better and more efficiently. And I'd like to start here with, you know, we've all heard about the prefrontal cortex and what makes us uniquely different from other species. But can you explain what it does and then how you're going to treat the prefrontal cortex?
Right. So the prefrontal cortex is a very special part of the brain. It is what makes us humans, and it's really the region that's responsible for letting us carry out analytical thinking, critical thinking, analysis, solving complicated differential equations, planning, decision-making, all of those things. What is so interesting about the prefrontal cortex in terms of the way we work when we're sitting down as knowledge workers to do any kind of knowledge work is the prefrontal cortex is one of the regions that has its connectivity, its configuration changed with different levels of norepinephrine. And we've known for a while, for the past, let's just say, almost 100 years, that there is a certain upside down U-curve in terms of how norepinephrine levels in the brain affect how we mentally perform. And we now know that one of the reasons for this is there is this distribution of different sort of receiving stations for norepinephrine in this prefrontal cortex. And when you get to middle levels of norepinephrine, that's when the prefrontal cortex is most engaged. And so harnessing that kind of Goldilocks zone is the best way to work. It's when our mental performance peaks. It's when we can think best, we can plan, we can make complex decisions. And so when we're talking about being hyper-efficient, that's what we want to be. That's how we want to be.
So we've all heard people say, and I always get this tinge of envy when I hear them say this, oh, I just got into this flow state and I just got so much done. So is that flow state, the way you sort of define the top of that bell curve or the upside down U, is when we are experiencing the norepinephrine and we're in the place we want to be most efficient and most focused.
One way to imagine this is to think of the brain as a sort of engine with three gear settings, 1, 2, and 3, slow, medium, and fast. And in a very simplistic metaphor, we can imagine that in gear 1, the levels of norepinephrine are lowest. In gear 2, they are medium. And in gear 3, they are at the highest. And the way you would feel in these three settings would be in gear 1, your thoughts would be quite slow, you'd be mind wandering. In gear 3, you'd be quite distracted, you'd be reactive. Every little distraction, every little kind of soft noise would sound louder. But in gear 2, it's somewhere in the middle where you can sit down and you can focus on something really well. And at this level, you have, in this gear setting, you have medium levels of norepinephrine. And you're quite right. There is a network in the brain called the Blue Dot Network, but its official name is the Locus Coeruleus Network. It's called the Blue Dot or Locus Coeruleus because it looks blue. It was first discovered by Marie Antoinette's physician, if that's of interest to your listeners. And this network actually fires in different patterns, really largely in three settings, which corresponds to these three gear states. And when it fires in kind of this medium setting, and there are these medium levels of norepinephrine, that seems to be the state that when flow is most likely to happen. A flow is a bit of a snap in, snap out state. So you can be in flow and suddenly snap out again. But when you're in this medium state, that's when we find that flow is most likely to happen. As norepinephrine levels vary in the brain, your pupils vary in size. So when norepinephrine levels are low, so when we're in setting gear 1, your pupils are at their smallest or narrowest. In gear 2, they're medium sized, and in gear 3, they are widest. And that's how we can measure from the outside sort of where on this bell curve you are, whether you are in this Goldilocks zone or not. And when people have been put through states that are very similar to flow, pupillometry studies have established that they are most likely to be in this gear 2 Goldilocks zone.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're talking with Dr. Meetu Staroni. She has written a book called Hyper Efficient: Optimize Your Brain to Transform the Way You Work. Well, let's stay on this gear thing. And we're a mountain town, we're a mountain biking town, and we are also used to automatically switching between gears. We can choose the gears that we use. Can we do that with our brains? Do we have that option to go from gear 1, bypass gear 2, maybe to gear 3?
So we actually already do that. When you wake up in the morning and you're feeling slightly sluggish and you reach for your cup of coffee or 3 cups of coffee, or you reach for your hot shower or you go for a quick run, what we're doing there is we're gearing up. We're going from a kind of a hazy gear 1 state in the metaphor I described up to gear 2 when you can actually focus. You know, before the coffee, the screen in front of you probably felt quite blurry. After the coffee, you suddenly make sense of what you're reading. So we already inadvertently do things to toggle our gears up and down. Emerging data suggests that these toggles do indeed work. There's a great experiment done quite recently which tracked some people's pupil sizes to gauge which gear they were in. And this experiment actually established that doing things like going for a quick bout of exercise or imagining something very, very fearful, ways in which you can kind of make your mind feel more alert or just kind of calm yourself down with breathing exercises and so on, these are actually ways in which we are actively switching our gears. Taking that a step further, a lot of the neurotech developing at the moment is actually focusing on this very maneuver. So they are ways in which you can use your own pupil sizes to figure out what your pupil size is by some kind of measuring device, and then you are using that to reduce the size and to expand the size. So there is experimental data on this, but practically we already do it. It's harder to come down a gear than it is to rise a gear. As you know, it's easy to have a coffee and feel more alert. It's harder to feel more relaxed, but there are indeed ways of doing it.
One of the things you talk about in the book is how being able to better understand our gears and utilize these gears really helps with our brain, the health of our brain as well. I mean, we are all so used to hearing that brain health is from external sources, you know, supplements, or maybe even meditation. But how does this hyper-efficiency of our brain help the actual health of the brain?
Well, there are really two reasons for it. One is data that is emerging very slowly, and we've sort of had an intuitive sense of it. That most recently, there was a great study a couple of years ago by a team, first author Omoluabi, and this study took a bunch of mice who were genetically modified to be more predisposed to having neurodegenerative illness. And these mice were put in brain states corresponding to gear three, where they were feeling stressed, as mice do indeed get stressed, and they were put in this stressed brain state. The same mice were then put through a different condition where they were put into a state that's similar to this Goldilocks zone gear two. They were put there for a little while every day, and having experienced that state, they were then put through a state of gear three. Now, the study found that being in gear three without being in gear two enough, so being in gear three for long bouts of time every day, actually accelerated neurodegenerative illness, neurodegenerative disease in these mice. Whereas putting them in a gear two state beforehand seemed to mitigate it. And this has been also, you know, covered by some other data, is that being in this middle state of gear two is actually quite neuroprotective, because it seems to be a state where all the homeostatic mechanisms in the brain, things that keep the brain kind of steady and healthy, seem to be optimal. This was the case with mice, but we know with humans, if we are in a state where we are always hyper-aroused, hyper-vigilant, on the edge of, you know, feeling very wired, feeling stressed, that can indeed disrupt this kind of regulatory processing and hence lead to possible trauma. In the case of the mice, we know that this was neurodegenerative disease. And we know with humans that chronic stress can cause shrinkage of white matter in the long term. So we do find all of these links. So the bottom line is, living in a very fast-paced life where you are constantly put into gear three may well be having consequences that we are not yet fully aware of.
So I'll give the example of myself yesterday. I had just gotten home from a rather long vacation. I was going about the house trying to figure out I was overwhelmed with the tasks and the things that piled up while I was away. And it rendered me sort of useless, really, without sitting down and making a list or doing, you know, whatever it is we as humans do to best organize and to feel less overwhelmed by, you know, stress or anxiety. So for the person who's not necessarily in, you know, full throttle mode all the time, but has bouts of stress and anxiety that come in, how does that affect what's going on with your gears, you know, with your pupil size?
So what's so interesting is that as this blue dot network fires faster and faster, and you get rising levels of norepinephrine in the brain, you can feel it, right? So the sort of the slight anxiety you feel when you suddenly encounter a situation that, whether it's having to deal with a pile of work, having to meet a deadline, that sort of a slight anxious state shows as a manifestation that your brain's norepinephrine levels have risen. Now, that's actually not all bad, because norepinephrine increases neuroplasticity. It enhances learning. And moments when we actually get acutely stressed, we actually have accelerated learning. But there's an interesting nuance here, which is, we talked about the prefrontal cortex. Another part of the brain is called the hippocampus, which is the brain center for learning and memory. This is more kind of long-term memory, long-term learning, whereas the prefrontal cortex incorporates working memory, which is like your temporary scratch pad. Now, when you have moderate levels of norepinephrine, your prefrontal cortex is fully engaged. But when you have high levels of norepinephrine, your hippocampus becomes more engaged and your prefrontal cortex stops being fully engaged. So there's almost this trade-off between the two. But this is fine because at moments when you really need to kind of suddenly push on the pedal, learn, make progress, conquer some kind of obstacle, you need that extra drive of norepinephrine. And actually a short, sharp bout of it enhances learning without making your prefrontal cortex go offline.
Ah, it's very interesting to talk about this and to think about what's going on in our brain. How do we bring this into daily practice?
So one way of doing it is, first of all, to realize that the way you feel actually has a very important role in what you're doing. So when you're sitting down to work in the morning, most of us sit down quite casually, not really caring. You might just reach for your coffee, do your usual routine. But instead, if you realize that actually the state of your brain changes from one task to another, it changes across the day. And if you can actually match the state of your mind to the work you're doing, you're more likely to do that work really well. So for instance, take attention. So we all talk about how attention is such an expensive commodity in this era of technology. Now, attention has a very interesting role. So if you're sitting down looking at a computer screen in front of you and you are focused, so that's great. We assume that that's universally great, but actually that's not so great if what you're doing is innovating or trying to think of a creative new idea. If that's what you're trying to do, then sitting at a computer looking at a screen is not going to bring you the best results. In that situation, you should actually unglue your attention and let it wander. Now, this doesn't mean that you have lots of other modes of information transfer. So it doesn't mean you look at your phone. It doesn't mean you kind of listen and reply to text messages. It really means you have to unglue your attention and let it wander. And if you can get into that state, that is optimal for creative idea generation. And one of the most effective ways of getting into that state, and it's a time-honored one as well, many great writers and thinkers have followed this, is going for a walk. When you're going for a walk, your eyes can't fixate on anything because your world is moving around you. At the same time, the process of walking is keeping you alert. So you're not kind of drifting into a sleepy, lethargic state. So you're alert and yet your attention is sharp, but it's floating. And there is data that if you do that, you're more likely to actually have measurably better performance with divergent thought. Another thing to remember is that we're all used to sitting down as knowledge workers, sitting down at a computer and working, even forgetting the role of creativity and focused attention. Simply sitting down and working for long hours is really at odds with the way our brains work, because many of your listeners will realize that if you sit, the last time you sat down and you suddenly came up with an idea, or you've managed to do a really good solid block of work, suddenly that state of mind just flows out of the window. And you think, what just happened? I've just done such great work for the last hour. The reason why that happens is because your brain operates in sort of cyclic rhythms and attention varies cyclically. And what this ultimately means is if your brain's attention dwindles, you are not going to be producing your best work. And if you take that a step further, if you sit down and work continuously, your brain gets tired. And sometimes the earliest or the most subtle indication of that is simply your attention drifting away. And if you persist in sitting down and continuing to work when you have mental fatigue, we now know that the connections within the brain, the functional connections, so the kind of the traffic that information transfer adopts across the brain, actually those routes become inefficient. So this traditional mode of sitting down to work and not getting up for most of the day is at odds with the brain's natural way of working on all of these different levels.
Well, Mita, you bring up a great point. Our work structure, our business structure is 9 to 5, sit at your desk, sit there all day, and with these expectations to continuously, constantly be productive. Well, you say most of us, a lot of us aren't productive. You know, I'm creative in the morning and I'm creative at night, and people all have their different cycles. So what can the modern workplace, and this includes remote working, because when you work remotely, you still sit at your computer all day. What can the modern workplace do to better allow for and enhance these different gear shifts and breaks and flow states?
First of all, I love what you just said there, that you're more creative in the morning and late in the evening. And as I think we discussed it a minute ago, we all have these different rhythms. And there is data that suggests that actually we do get into these creative states first thing in the morning and last thing at night. And that is actually outside the time window when most people come to work. So what I suggest we do is first, we start looking at work in a completely different way. The idea of looking at work in terms of output actually emerged during the era of the assembly line, principally, and it lasted ever since then. And we've applied the same assembly line template onto all kinds of work, whether it's a doctor seeing patients in the clinic, or whether it's a financier working at their desk in an office. The problem is, if you measure output, it's all very good if you're producing hair dryers and refrigerators. But if you're producing ideas or mental products, especially when we have all these new tools now, AI and automation, which really are our sort of assistants who do all the low-level mental work for us. If the work we're doing now involves higher level thinking work and we're producing ideas, we're solving problems, we're figuring out how to use this AI tool to make the next incredible presentation, for that kind of idea generation, the brain does not have an assembly line inside your head where bits of the idea is being joined together and coming out at the end. 100 bad ideas are just as bad as one bad idea, but one good idea is better than 1,000 bad ideas. So first we have to start measuring work in terms of quality. The second step, ideally, is if we have a way of working where we tailor the work for the task at hand. So whatever a team is working on, if a team is working on something that requires focus, their hours are going to be different from a team that's working on creativity. Similarly, the way you schedule your day, when you do your meetings, the time yet when you wake up, when you schedule perhaps a nap if possible, all of those things can be scheduled according to the specific kind of work you're doing. So as an example, if you're doing innovative work, you might want to start extremely early in the day. You might want to wake up as early as 5:30 and then start, get 2 or 3 hours solid work done, and then progress to focused work, or then take a large chunk of the day, of the middle of the day off as a trade-off for coming in early. Similarly, you could extend that at the end of the day. If you really enhance and emphasize these golden hours for doing these specific kinds of work and tailor the work to the rhythm of these of an individual's brain, you're much more likely to get the work done well.
Well, you brought up the idea of, the component of AI in the workplace. And I've been reading a lot about the difference between knowledge workers, which basically AI is becoming a knowledge worker, and wisdom workers, where it's like, especially those of us with older brains can actually incorporate the wisdom that we've learned. So how do we, let's just say humans, compete with our brains and AI in the workplace? Or is it a competition, or do we need to better utilize it to, enhance our ability to work?
So I love that idea of wisdom and knowledge worker. I think the bottom line should be AI and technology are helping us rather than competing against us. And so rather than try to outpace them, because what do? They work faster. If you see them as a knowledge worker entity, that AI knowledge worker works faster and works with a bigger volume per unit of time. no matter how fast we work or how large the volumes of work we do are, we will not be able to compete against a machine. And this is comes back down to not looking at work output in terms of quantity. AI and automation are taking away the lower level cognitive work, which were to our brains and minds what repetitive assembly line manual work was to manual workers. So they are actually going to help enhance our mental output if we learn to use them wisely. And so rather than compete on the quantity front, what we should be doing, just as your beautiful description of wisdom worker, we should be using our own brains to enhance the quality of work. So the edge of one organization is going to be the quality of the human output rather than the quantity of machine output, which ultimately will probably converge to the same level across organizations.
Wow. The book is Hyper Efficient: Optimize Your Brain to Transform the Way You Work. Our guest is Dr. Meetu Staroni. Meetu, before we let you go, I just have to follow up on something I've been thinking about since you've been talking. And I'll use our job, Katie and my job, as an example. Most of us have to use different types of approaches. So, for example, we are hanging on your every word. We love doing this job because we're so focused for the 25 minutes we're speaking with you. So we're wide open and very focused. But at the same time, we need to be using a creative approach, formulating the next question. So many of us have both, you know, input and output at the same time going. How do we best navigate that?
So this is such an interesting question. If you look inside the brain when you're doing any kind of work, your brain does not stay static. So it does change. So when I talk about largely being in gear two, I mean predominantly being in the state where you can focus. But even when you're sitting down to focus, your brain is still doing some ballet and gymnastics. Every time you close your eyes, there's an increase in alpha oscillations, alpha waves in the brain. And alpha waves are thought to act like in windshield wipers, or they basically smooth out, they rub out, they clear out your mental slate. And that clearing out of the mental slate has to happen while you are sitting down and working. To your question about creativity, you're sitting down, you're paying attention, you're listening. That's a focused zone. But in between that, you are thinking of little fragments of data, of information that you're kind of joining together, having heard what I just said. And that joining together process, for that to happen, your attention does need to drift. So being in a state of mind where you can focus is the absolute basic, and you can toggle ways to do that. But once you're sitting down to focus, if you know what you're doing is going to require a little bit of creative thinking, it's best to be in that zone where your attention can occasionally detach and take a wander.
Well, that is wonderful. The book is Hyper Efficient. And Dr. Meetu Staroni, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to KPCW Park City, Utah at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County and 91.9 FM in Wasatch County. Stream us live on kpcw.org.